Hey, Creepaholic fans, welcome back to Creepaholics. So, I'm your host, Shanice, and this is episode 9, and we are doing the Charlie Ross kidnapping. You ever hear that phrase, don't take candy from strangers? Don't get into cars with people you don't know? There's a reason why your parents told you that. So, I'm going to tell you where that phrase originated from. This is the kidnapping of Charlie Ross. So let's get into the abduction of Charlie Ross. So on July 1st, 1874, there was a 4-year-old boy named Charlie Ross and a 5-year-old boy named Walter Lewis Ross, which was Charlie's brother. They were playing in the front yard of their family's home in Germantown, a well-to-do section of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. One day, a horse-drawn carriage pulled up to the residence, and the boys were approached by two men who offered candy and fireworks and offered to take them for a ride. To go and get them for the Independence Day celebration that was coming up. The boys soon agreed and were transported throughout Philadelphia to a store where the two men asked Walter to go in and buy fireworks and candy with 25 cents that they had given him. Walter did so, but the carriage left without him. From that day, Charlie Ross was never seen again. His father, Christian K. Ross, began receiving ransom demands from the apparent kidnappers. There's all sorts of forms of notes that were mailed to the post offices in Philadelphia. They were all written in like an odd handwriting and in coarse, semi-literate styles with many simple words that were just misspelled. I don't know if they were illiterate or if they were trying to make it untraceable, but most of them were uncomprehensible. So the communications requested for the Ross family to pay $20,000 for Charlie's return. That's about $400,000 today, just in case if you're wondering how much that would be. But the notes did caution to Mr. Ross not to call the police and threatened Charlie's life, sorry, if Christian did so. If he did not cooperate, they would kill him. So while the kidnappers had assumed that the family was very wealthy, Christian's ownership of a small dry goods food store wasn't actually doing good. They were in heavy debt due to the stock market crash in 1873, so there was no way Christian was going to be able to pay the ransom for his son's return. Soon after, the kidnapping became national. Due to heavy press coverage and some prominent Philadelphians enlisted the help of the famous Perkinton National Detective Agency, who had millions of flyers and posters that were printed with Charlie Ross's likeliness. So it's a sketch that they created that looks like him. Back then there weren't a lot of photographs, so this was a way for everyone to see what he looked like, and the sketch is actually really good. I will post it on my pages. If you want to take a look at that, you can look at the photos and the comparisons of Charlie Ross and the other gentleman that we will get into at the end. So, a popular song based on this crime was composed by Dexter Smith and W.H. Brockway, entitled Bring Back Our Darling. There were several attempts were made to provide the kidnappers with the ransom money, as directed in the notes, but in each case, the kidnappers either failed to appear or stopped communication. So, I don't know if they were trying to play a game or what they were trying to do, but it seems like it was just cat and mouse at this point. So why don't we get into the suspects? So later on that year, on the night of December 13th in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, New York, there was a house that actually belonged to a judge called Charles Van Brunt, and it was burglarized by two men. Or sorry, Holmes Van Brunt, Charles' brother, who lived next door, gathered armed members of his household to stop the intruders in the act. Holmes' group entered Charlie's house and brought down the burglars with a torrent of gunfire. The burglars, Bill Mosher and Joel Douglas, were career criminals who actually had recently been released from jail. Now, Mosher was actually killed on site by gunfire, but Douglas was mortally wounded at the scene. He managed to live for about 2 hours and was able to communicate with Holmes to give him a clear story of what happened. So there's really no clear consciousness in regarding if what Douglas said was true, like if he said it was because he was dying or because of all of who was present and he was too shaken up by the night's events to give accurate reports. They can't really tell if he was truthful in what he said. So Douglas may have said that the lying was pointless as he knows he was mortally wounded and had thusly admitted to that he and Mosher had abducted Charlie Ross. Douglas believed that he had reported that Ross was killed and Mosher knew where the boy was, possibly adding that he would return unharmed to his family within a few days. Douglas did not give any clues on Ross's location or particulars of the crime and soon died afterwards before that information was gathered. So, Charlie's brother Walter was taken to the New York City to look for the bodies, to look at the bodies of Mosher and Douglas. Soon after, he determined, to determine if these two men were the actual men from the carriage ride that night, Walter actually confirmed that they were the same men who took the boys from in front of their house. So previous that summer, Mosher, in he was like very and he was a very identifiable man. So he had very distinctive malformed nose, which is kind of what set Walter off. So Walter described him as a monkey nose, and I guess that was the one character that he remembered when his brother was taken. So the cartilage of Mosher's nose actually had been destroyed by syphilis or cancer. They didn't really determine what happened to his nose. So yeah, he just kind of looked like a monkey apparently. But beyond reasonable doubt, Charlie Ross was still missing at this point. So even with finding these men after the burglary and them dying, Charlie was still missing. So, it's a lot. These parents are missing their son. The brother went and identified the two men that took him, but still there's no leads on where he is. So soon after this all happened, there was a trial. So a former police officer by the name of William Westervelt, he was also known as an associate of Mosher and his wife's brother. He was arrested and held in connection with the case. He was tried in 1875 for the kidnapping. Although Westervelt was a friend and perhaps a confidant of Mosher, while he was awaiting in prison, he told Christian that his son had been alive at the time of Mosher's death, but there was virtually no evidence to tie him to the crime itself. So Walter insisted that Westervelt was not one of the men in the carriage that looked. So Westervelt was found not guilty of the kidnapping, but however, they did charge him with a lesser crime of conspiracy. So he did maintain his innocence, and he did swear that he had no idea where the whereabouts of Charlie Ross was. So he ended up going to jail for 6 years. So while he's in jail, about 2 years after the kidnapping, his father, Charlie Ross's father, actually published a book titled The Father's Story of Charlie Ross, The Kidnapped Child. And all the money that was raised from this book was used to continue to search for his son. But by 1878, the media interest in this case had began to wind down a little bit. There was not really much new interest in the case. So when Ross printed out the book, he began giving lectures in Boston to try and get the word out there about his son, and maybe, who knows, someone can come forward and help. So Christian and his wife did search for their son until they died. So Christian did die in 1897, and his wife died in 1912. They did follow leads. They actually interviewed over 570 boys and teenagers, and eventually grown men from all around the world came to the Charlies, trying to prove that they were Charlie Ross, but he never came. So even though everyone who did come was an imposter, they actually ended up spending $60,000 looking for their son. So in 1924, there was a newspaper that began running the stories about the cases to coincide with the Fifth Avenue anniversary or 50th anniversary of Ross's abduction. By that time, Walter was an adult and was working as a stockbroker. And he said that he and his three sisters still receive letters from middle-aged men claiming to be his brother. So even though they're grown up and it's 1924, they're still receiving letters from people claiming to be Charlie. So, it's a very well-known case, and they are a little bit of a wealthy family, so I can see why tons of people are trying to. But the story does not stop there. So in 1934, Gustavo Blair, a 69-year-old carpenter that was living in Phoenix, Arizona at the time, actually petitioned a court to recognize him as the real Charlie Ross. Blair claimed that after he was abducted, he lived in a cave and was eventually adopted by a man who told him he was Ross. Walter dismissed Blair as a crank and added that the idea that my brother is still alive is not only absurd, but the man's story seems unconvincing. We've long ago given up on the hope that Charlie's would ever be found alive. As Blair's claims went uncontested, the court actually ruled that he was Charlie Brewster Ross in March of 1939. But despite the ruling, the Charlie Ross family refused to recognize Blair as his, as their relative, as his brother. They did not believe that this man was Charlie. So this man, now with his name changed back to Charlie Ross, moved back to his hometown with his wife. And Blair actually ended up dying in December 1943. And still, after his death, when he died, up to the day he died, he still claimed that he was Ross. Blair's claims that he occasionally had reported as false, as descendant in December 1943, still claiming that he was Ross. Blair's claims had occasionally been reported as false, as untrue. But DNA testing showed that he was actually a man named Nelson Miller. However, no official testing results have ever been reported or released to the public as liable information. So, the case in particular, the fates of Mosher, Douglas, and Westervelt, served as a deterrent to other potential ransom kidnappers. It would be a quarter of a century before another high-profile ransom case would emerge, with Edward Cuddy Jr. in 1900s. The common admonition, "Don't take candy from strangers," is said to have come from Ross's abduction. The Charlie Project, a major missing persons database, is named for Ross. While waiting for President Franklin D. Roosevelt to appear at the actual 1936 Democrat National Convention, they concluded at Franklin Fields in Philadelphia, newspaper columnist H. L. McKinley noted a prank had been played on the public. So it did end up becoming a prank. It actually wasn't real, unfortunately. So unfortunately, Franklin Roosevelt's appearance didn't really have the impact he wanted. So now we're going to get into Edward Cuddy Jr. We're just going to stop and have a little break, and I'll be back with how Edward Cuddy Jr. ties into the Charlie Ross case. So now we're going to get into Edward Cuddy Jr. He's also known as Eddie Cuddy, or for this episode, we're going to call him Edward Jr. So he was kidnapped on December 18th in 1900s. This is a quarter century after Charlie Ross was kidnapped. So he was kidnapped in Omaha, Nebraska. Now, Edward Cuddy was a very wealthy owner of Cuddy Packing Company, which was helped built by the Omaha Stockyards through the 1950s. Cuddy Sr., his father, actually paid the ransom for the return of his son and made the kidnappers, Pat Crow, a popular author, lecturer, and actor for a brief period. The Cuddy case is said to have influenced many succeeding kidnappings, in those of the Lindbergh baby, Bobby Greenlease, and Marion Packer. So, Pat Crow, sorry, also known as Frank Roberts, was an American criminal who was implicit in the kidnapping of Edward Cuddy Jr. in Omaha, Nebraska. He later became a lecturer and writer. So, Crow's criminal story started as a bank and train robber. Then he kidnapped Edward and became famous across the United States. Then he began speaking about his exploits in the late 1900s. But according to Time magazine, Crowe's misdemeanors began with robbing Omaha streetcars in 1890 and including a diamond theft, homicidal attempts, a visit to and escape from Gillette Prison, holdups, and pilfering on railroads. After his last acquittal, though, Cuddy's trial, the Omaha Daily News described him as one of the few really spectacular and truly named desperados of the day. When Obituary called him one of the most colorful figures in American criminal history. So today, his personal narratives of Cuddy's story are actually studied for their authenticity. And I know there's a little bit more information on that, but I don't want to go too much into Pat Crowe. I just wanted to let you know what he had to do with the case. So on the evening of December 18th, 1900, a 15-year-old Edward Cuddy Jr. had left his house to run errands for his old Gold Coast neighborhood. As he was walking home, a carriage pulled up beside him and a man jumped out, grabbed him, pulled him inside, and kidnapped him. His father, the millionaire owner of Cuddy Packing Company at the Omaha Stockyards, returned from a dinner engagement around 10:30 that evening, and he discovered that his son was missing. So the next morning, the Omaha Bee, the Daily News, and the World Herald all carried the story across the nation. So the next morning, Cuddy closed his plant and encouraged all 2,000 of his workers to look for his son. So instead of working, he gathered all of his employees and said, "We're going to search for my son. Let's go." His competitors did the same. Soon after, there were 7,000 people searching the Omaha area at 9 a.m. for his son. He did receive a phone call advising him to search his front yard, where his coachman found a ransom note. The ransom note said, "Mr. Cuddy, we have kidnapped your child and demanding $25,000 for a safe return. If you give us the money, he will return as safe as when you last saw him. But if you refuse, we will put acid in his eyes and blind him. Get the money, all in gold, $5, $10, and $20 pieces. Getting your buddy alone on the night of December 9th at 7 p.m. Follow the paved road towards Fremont, where you come to a lantern by the side of the road. Place the money by the lantern and immediately turn your horse and return home. Turn your horse around and return home." The kidnappers foresaw the possibility of Cuddy not paying the ransom, so referred in the note from the kidnappers that the kidnapping of Charlie Ross, age 4, in Philadelphia on July 1st, 1874, after being advised by the police not to pay the ransom, his father, Christian Ross, a wealthy merchant, never saw his child again. The Cuddy kidnapper noted that Christian Ross regretted for the rest of his life that if he took the advice of the police, he would regret it. So the note does continue. "Ross did die of a broken heart. Sorry that he allowed the detectives to dictate to him. Cuddy, you are up against it, and there is only one way out. Give up the coin. Money we want, and money we will get. If you don't give up, you can lead your boy blind for the rest of your days." So at 7 o'clock on the night of the 19th, Cuddy arrived where the lantern was placed on the side of the road, alone, as instructed, near Little Papio Creek. He left the money along with a note in reply to the kidnappers, and he returned back to his mansion approximately around 9:30 p.m. Eddie Jr. returned home at 1 a.m. unharmed. So his son was returned after he paid the ransom. He followed the instructions, and that was it. But the nation's response to him paying the kidnappers fueled a massive nationwide debate. The San Francisco Examiner actually condemned the actor Mr. Cuddy had acted as a bad citizen because it will encourage others to do so. The Omaha Bee noted that Cuddy spoke in a nonchalant tone after paying the $25,000 as he thought He just dropped a nickel down a cellar grate. That's what they stated in their articles that they put out. So why don't we talk a little bit about the manhunt of Cuddy and what pursued during it? So Cuddy did do a posting of $25,000 reward and hired the Pinkerton Detective Agency. Sound familiar? That was the same agency that was used for Charlie Ross's case. So they were the ones that did lead the manhunt, which the World Herald called the nation's leading thrill. After a statement from Eddie Jr., the reporters found the kidnappers' hideout in South Omaha. Pat Crow, so that was the man that I mentioned earlier, he was a small butcher operator at the time in South Omaha and was identified as a suspect earlier in the investigation. But however, nobody could find where Crow was. But during January 1901, Crow sightings were reported from Central America to Nantucket Island, which, with one report, placing him on a steamship in the Honduras and another at Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. Thousands of Crow wanted posters were shipped all across the United States trying to find this wanted man. But in March of 1901, the Omaha City Council actually matched Cuddy's reward and letter in the month, in about a month. A man named James Callahan was arrested for public drunkenness and he was fined to pay $20 gold coin, just like Cuddy had paid the ransomers. Cuddy was also known to associate with Crow. Police observed Callahan was also known to associate with Crow. Police observed Callahan paying with the coins at the taverns in Omaha. But on the night of March 21st, they arrested him for robbing Cuddy Sr. of $25,000. When he did go to trial, he did not face kidnapping charges. Nebraska had none of that applied to kidnapping of a 16-year-old within the city limits. So at that time, they could not charge him with that. But they did soon charge him. But that will soon change. It did not change Callahan's trial. But on April 28th, the jury found him not guilty of robbery. But in another trial in November, he was also found not guilty. Crow communicated with the Omaha Police Department through mail, despite arguing to turn himself in and trying to negotiate the drop of ransom in late 1901. Crow never showed up. But in the spring of 1905, he turned up in Omaha and gave an interview to World Herald reporter. However, he disappeared once again. But on September 5th, 1905, he was spotted at a tavern in Little Bohemia. The ensuing gunfight left one of the police officers wounded, and Crow vanished once again. So this mobster obviously has some skill. He knows how to get away from people. So finally, in November 1905, Crow was captured by the police in Butte, Montana. On November 28, 1905, Crow pleaded not guilty to the shooting of the Omaha police officer in September. Battle on Hickory Street is what the newspapers called it. But he was also charged with a robbing of a streetcar in Omaha for $50. And for a robbery in Cuddy's kidnapping case. Despite 4 days of testimonies and dozens of witnesses, the jury acquitted Crow after 80 minutes. So 80 minutes doesn't sound like a long time, but if you sit there thinking about sitting in one place for 80 minutes, that is a long period of time. So after they did all their deliberations and everything, the judge held him for the next trial. So the next trial did begin in February 1906. There was about 92 witnesses that were called by prosecution, and none was called by the defense. So it doesn't really seem like the defense had a very strong case there, unfortunately. But the Chicago Exclaimer followed the case along with many and many nationwide newspapers, which proclaimed that the defense's closing statement to be considered to be. It was considered the best speech and criminal case ever made in Omaha. After 17 hours of deliberations on St. Patrick's Day, 1906, the jury declared Crow not guilty. Responding to the trial, the Washington Post wrote, "Omaha is evidently a happy hunting ground for savages and male factories." So the aftermath of this trial and what happened to Crow, Crow's criminal criminal history gained fame. So he became a lecturer and an author across the United States, but he did eventually die from poverty in Harlem in 1938. All of his personal narratives, like I said in the beginning, are studied today for authenticity. They kidnapped, influenced Omaha businessmen to keep their children under close watch, including tycoon Gordon W. Wattleys, who eventually moved to Hollywood to escape the tensions in Omaha. Cudley Jr.'s family moved from Omaha to Chicago in 1910. He did serve in World War I and married Margaret Carey in 1919. The couple did end up having three children, but soon later divorced in 1942. His wife died several months after the divorce, and in 1944, Cuddy married Eleanor Peabody Cochan. He eventually became chairman of a board of the board Cuddy Packing and Leading Company out of Omaha in the 1950s, and retiring to Arizona, where he eventually died in 1966. So these kidnappers said that he didn't want to make the same mistake as Charlie Ross's father did. So Charlie Ross's kidnapping actually instigated these men to kidnap Edward Jr. So that's why I wanted to bring this into the case to let you know the whole story of it and how it began. So that's really all I have for you for this episode. I know it was a little bit rocky there. I have a new mic and it's not really working too well, so I'm just trying to figure it out. And my cat's been sitting here beside me, attacking my foot for like the last couple of recordings. So I'm very sorry, guys. So why don't we start with letting you know what's going on with my page. So just to let you guys know, my Patreon page has opened up. So if you haven't heard, I do have some merchandise on there. We got some hoodies, some posters, some stickers, some mugs. There's also a few other things on there you can check out. We do also have some tiers, which is a way of supporting the show. Or, if you just feel free, you want to listen and send a notification or subscribe to my channel, that is perfect. I appreciate all the love for all my supporters. So if you just want to drop me a message or, if you just want to talk, I'd love to hear from you. You can email me at blackheartinc12@gmail.com or Facebook me at Creepaholics. You can also check out my Patreon page, patreon.com/creepaholics or supporter.acast.com. I also have a new webpage that has been uploaded. It's called creepaholics.wordpress.com. So, if you enjoyed my episode, feel free to check those out. Hit the like, subscribe button, whatever you prefer. And also, too, like I said, I will post some photos of this case up on my sites. So if you'd like to check that out, that would be great. I am your host, Shanice. This is Creepaholics, and thanks for creeping it real, guys.
Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ha 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 ha.